Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some in the air.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. And in the studio today, finally, this is episode 121. It's been a few years now that I've been doing this program, and I feel like you were probably one of the first people I asked to come on the show, and it's so great to actually get you on the show. You're a very, very busy man. And welcome to the show, Joaquin Simo of Pouring Ribbons in New York City.
I would like to thank you very much for having me on. I would additionally like to thank you for securing a Divine Pig Products sponsor to be the one who's sponsoring this show. As so many people around the city knows, there's no part of that animal I will not happily consume. So this is unbelievably fitting. Thank you.
Awesome. So okay, I remember back in the day, I was working in the little whiskey shop in Red Hook, and I'd met Brian Miller and Capel Tomlinson, and you and Brian Miller were working together at the time at Death & Company. And I had never been, but Linnell Smothers she would go on and on about it. And this is also back in the day when, like, Damon Dyer was working at Jack the Horse, you know. Those were the good old days. And I remember going there for my very first time to go to Death & Company. I didn't know anyone there except for Brian, but he wasn't there that night. And you were my bartender that night. And I... So, like, I almost cringed right after I ordered this drink, because I know what it means to order this drink, but I kind of, like, I was there, I ordered Ramos Gin Fizz, and you were just like, yeah, man, you didn't even flinch, you were just like, yeah, man, totally, let's do it. And then you didn't shake it for 12 minutes, but I wouldn't have expected you to anyway. It was like, it was a hot summer day, and I was just like really craving one.
Sure.
And then I realized that I was probably an asshole. But what do you think about that? I mean, like, let's go to the Ramos Gin Fizz, because since we're coming up on the spring and summer.
I have kind of a mixed relationship with that drink in particular, because I adore it, but pretty much only before 2 or 3 p.m. I think it is the perfect brunch drink.
Absolutely.
When someone comes in and wants to order three of those at midnight on a Friday, I am baffled. It's like the very last thing that I would ever want at that hour. I get why the drink is appealing, but for me, that drink is appealing given a very specific context, and that's like daytime drinking.
Just like a Bloody Mary.
Exactly. I never want one of those after it's dark out. Ever.
Yeah, ever. I don't want one after... I mean, like, I will not have a Bloody Mary after my first meal of the day.
Yeah, no, that's totally
fair. Which is usually lunch.
Yeah. not after 5.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Right.
But I think that... So I'm going to go ahead on air here and apologize for ordering that drink after dark.
It's fine. Look, you made it. It's good.
But then you made another drink for me after that. It was the Latin Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
The
which is the exact opposite of that drink.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Small, brown and stirred, really easy.
but still in the New Orleans mindset. You know?
Absolutely, it's a rum Sazerac.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's where we met, and I'm really glad that we got to meet that way. And especially that you didn't like immediately scoff, you know, and like for me. Yeah,
well, I mean, that was my job at Death & Company. I was supposed to be the nice one. I was working next to like Grumpy Phil and Old Man Miller. I mean, that was like Waldorf and Statler behind the bar. I mean, someone had to smile, I guess. So, that was my job. So, of course, you know, happy to make that Ramos Gin Fizz, you know.
And it was delicious, by the way.
Thank God.
Let's talk about Pouring Ribbons here for a little bit.
Sure.
You left Death & Company to... You weren't anywhere between Death & Company and Pouring Ribbons, were you?
No,
yeah,
I wasn't.
You went
I was at D&C for 5.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I was, I think, the last of the original staff to leave. Like, they just could not get rid of me. I clung to that place like a barnacle. It was lovely. And I left... we took over the space that was then White Noise in May, the very beginning of May of 2012. I went to Tails that year, and the week after Tales that year was my last three shifts at Death & Company, right when I got back. So I was able to announce from the stage at Tales that, hey, I'm opening this new bar this fall. You guys should come check it out. I've got three shifts left at D&C. Come harass me. And those last three shifts, as you would imagine, were murder. I finished up at D&C in August of that year, and we opened up September 14th. 2012. So we're about a year and a half in now. It's been about 18 months.
Nice.
Yeah.
Let's talk about leaving a bar that you've been at for that time. Like putting in that kind of tenure. It's like it's got to be really difficult to move past, right?
It's profoundly difficult to leave that bar. I mean, it's an amazing environment. It's an amazing stage. It is challenging. You never felt like you stopped learning there. The crew of people that I got a chance to work with was so humbling and so inspiring that choosing to leave that, the only reason I would have left for that would have been for a place that I really felt strongly about and a place that was really my own. And, you know, to this day, Death & Company is still home. You know, it's probably the bar that I will stop in casually at more than anyone else, mainly because I feel like my body is hardwired to walk down across 6 between 1st and A anytime I'm going to or from the F train. So I always end up at least walking past it, and then half the time I'll just stop in and make fun of whoever's working, stop in for a cheeky shot or, you know, say something. And it's like, you know, I still get invited to menu tastings, and, you know, I'm able to give some critical feedback as they're working through stuff because I'm so well-versed in what a house-style drink is there.
Sure.
So they still continue to invite me on that. I had some input on the book that'll be coming out later this year. So, I mean, I still feel like they have, even though I left a year and a half ago, they continue to see me as part of the family there, and I'm extraordinarily blessed because that's the worst part about leaving a job that you love that much is thinking, now I'll just be gone and forgotten. And it's nice to see that they still consider me part of the family too.
Yeah, that's really important.
They're so much my family, and I love that dark little room so much. It's just, you know, I grew a lot in that room, and I wouldn't be where I wouldn't be sitting here if I hadn't been in that room for 5.5 years. So that I never take that for granted.
No, you'd still be sitting here.
Oh, okay.
Because you're just a great dude.
Sweet. Hey.
So that's awesome. Yeah, it's really like, it's hard for me to leave my bar even at the end of a shift, rather than like, not, you know, not instead of just a whole like tenure there. But so you about a year and a half ago opened up Pouring Ribbons, and so okay, first of all, let's talk about the space, because it's the second floor of a 2-story building,
right
on Avenue B.
Yep, between 13th and 14th, we're right above a liquor store. Everyone asks where the fireman's pole downstairs is going to be, and it's like I'm still waiting to see if we can get the landlord to greenlight that. Second floor bar. So, you know, kind of like Pegu Club, where it's set up with a very minimal street presence, which is sort of a blessing and sort of a curse in both ways. It had been a litany of bars, most of them dens of iniquity in places where people generally went to make poor to bad decisions. places like White Noise, like The Hose, Uncle Ming's for a really long time. I mean, this place was home to a lot of like really seedy, kind of gloriously debauched times in the East Village for a long time. And so, of course, like we come in and we turn into this kind of upscale cocktail bar. And that first month of watching the old regulars come through and just be baffled by what was going on in there was actually quite funny. But, you know, some of those regulars converted to be regulars of ours. And I think some of that was that they used to go in there and just like have a good time and be able to always invite their friends over. And we're a big enough space, especially for a place that's primarily known as a craft cocktail bar, where for the most part, we don't have to say no when people are like, oh, can we get 4 more people in here? Can we do it? It's like, yeah, as long as they don't mind standing. You know what I mean? We have enough room where we can allow standing.
You don't have a policy of...
No. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we have this big wide room like the, that's whenever people harp on like formerly Milk and Honey, now Attaboy, PDT, Death and Co. for being elitist and not letting people stand and having all these rules. Like a lot of that came from the physicality of those spaces. These were like super narrow rooms where if you had a bar that took up half of the available space and you had seats and at Death & Company, those like little black ottomans that jut out from those tables are pretty much invisible in that pitch black room.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? If you had a layer of people standing behind the bar guests, then just getting drinks back and forth behind them and around them would be much more challenging. Like PDT is even narrower, yeah. You know, so those spaces had a lot of those rules due to necessity and not because they were trying to keep out the undesirables. You know, people would come in and be like, this place isn't packed. You're like, yeah, because where the hell would you put people? We have a much wider room.
Yeah.
You know, we have a much bigger, longer, wider room. And that's given us a lot of flexibility with having standing room, with having just drink rails where people can go and hang out and do that. And I'm happy for it because I like that buzz. You know, the thing about seating only bars is that it makes it very hard to meet people there. And while we always joke that Death & Company may have been one of the best date bars in all of the world, that we probably had more like key first, third dates, and maybe engagements than most bars had any right to, I don't think anyone ever picked anyone up there. Like, because anytime someone would go up to, like, hit on the two cute girls who were sitting at the bar, like, you'd have a server or a bartender or a host coming over and salting game. Like, that was their job. You're like, I'm sorry, sir, you have to go back to your seat. It's like, sometimes that spared the girls from being hit on by people they didn't want to, but sometimes they wanted to talk to homeboy. Yeah. And we had to send him back to, you know, table 7, where they would just gaze forlornly at each other go meet at the Cherry Tavern after.
Yeah.
And it was like, fuck. so, you know, it's nice to have a place where people can walk up and meet people. And so I like that, you know, a bigger room allows for a certain level of conviviality.
Yeah.
And so I think that was one of the key considerations that we had when looking at the space. But obviously it's a big room, and so you sacrifice some intimacy, and it takes more guests in there to really kind of achieve that level, like that party buzz feel in a room. So, you know, it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, I think the layout of the place is really cool because you've got like the kind of, it's almost split into like a bar room and then like a, for lack of a better term, like a dining room, like seating room area, like by the windows in the front, you know, so you can actually have like larger parties that probably don't want to be like in the buzzy like bar area. And then like you've got the bar. So, but another thing I really like about the place is the I went to school for graphic design, like color study and all this stuff.
Yep,
and so like hot colors really like stimulate your appetite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why like McDonald's and Wendy's and like Taco Bell have like yellow and red and orange. But cool colors like calm you down and like keep you hanging around. That's why a lot of like, for instance, grocery stores have cooler colors.
Right.
Greens and blues to make you slow down and shop more, you know? So this is going to sound weird, but I really like I love the colors. You've got a lot of like cool colors. You got blues and like greens and the floor is really cool. It's
like this kind of faded out blue
stained wood, you know? But to me, I really like that because when I go there, I want to like hang out and chill out and like just chill the fuck out, man. Yeah. Cause like, you know, already run around too much, you know, and plus, like, speaking of the blues and greens, especially the greens, you guys have, like, this entire menu of vintage chartreuse.
Yeah.
And so, like...
We like green.
Yeah, you like green.
Yeah.
For sure. And so, just by virtue of the same, the color and the vibe of the room and, like, how I like to chill out, especially with chartreuse, the liqueur, like... I like to sit there and just hang out and sip on chartreuse.
It's a comfortable room, and I think, we worked with a wonderful design firm called Warren Red, and Dieter Cartwright was a guy who kind of did a lot of the room design stuff, and Jonathan McElroy was the graphic specialist in that. So we work with Jonathan on the menu layout and the matrix and all of that, and we work with Dieter, and he would show us, went through dozens of like mood boards and samples and look at this, and he would kind of study what we reacted to, but they also looked at what we were wearing to the meetings, you know, and they looked at a lot of that. And then what ended up happening was I ended up with a bar that was largely like shades of blue with occasional pops of orange and a lot of gray. And, you know, a lot of kind of traditional fabrics and kind of things like that. I was like, oh, yeah, they are pretty much looking exactly at what I'm wearing.
Like you could stand against the wall and disappear.
I just disappear into the space. And it was like, it was really funny because they took a lot of their cues, not only from the images that we responded to, but what were we, you know, telling them about our kind of sartorial and aesthetic sensibilities simply by how we were presenting ourselves to them in the meetings. And so we had a really interesting time with that. The Chartreuse collection was put together by my partner, Troy Seidel, who kind of went down that rabbit hole after a trip to the office in Chicago, where he got tasted on a couple of old bottles of Chartreuse. And Troy has yet to emerge from that rabbit hole. He is lost. I mean, he's lost in the ether somewhere. I think he's on 122 of the 130 herbs. In Chartreuse. I don't know. He's lost somewhere in that, and it's a very happy place to be lost in. But we're very proud to offer that. I mean, I know it was a challenging thing to kind of present to guests, like, oh, here's this weird liqueur that's been made by French monks for a few hundred years. You should drink really expensive old versions of this. And actually, shockingly, the reaction's been very good.
It's amazing.
And yeah, we've kind of the way we've priced everything of it, making it available by the half ounce makes even having tastes of something more accessible, which has been nice. And I think taking something that's been largely seen as either an after dinner drink or a modifier in dusty classics and elevating it to its own status was a bold move, but it served to differentiate us well, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's delicious monk juice. What's wrong with that?
Not anything that I've ever come across. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue talking about I'd love to talk about the way that you guys have set up the flow of the bar and the way that you guys approach the staff moving around there.
All right,
back in a second with Joaquin Simo.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
That was some very emotional harmonica playing in that song. Jack, who was that?
That is The Hollows, a band called The Hollows. I mean, ham's emotional, man, you know?
Dude, that's amazing.
It's country ham.
I love it. Oh, dude, ham is emotional.
Yeah.
I get very emotional when I eat ham. Yeah. That was the hardest part about giving up drinking for January, which I try to do after the holidays, is like having a really good piece of ham and then not being able to have sherry with it. I'm like, oh God, it wounds me so much. Like, yeah, you can take staff shots without me. That's fine. But like, no sherry with ham. I'm like, I feel less than. Yeah.
You know, I find it really interesting about how like sherry has come back around into play. And I think probably stronger than ever, really. You know, like over the last like 5 years. It's like edging its way back into the spotlight with like not just it came through with cocktails, but then also like there's so much more awareness of sherry and just drinking it straight and like the traditional stuff.
Yeah, no, I love it. Couldn't be happier about it. And you have like down in DC, you have Chantel who's running Mockingbird Hill, which has like 50 sherries. Mm-hmm. Available by the glass in East Village, Terroir has been pushing. They were actually giving it away.
Yeah.
They had a free sherry happy hour where they would give you a glass of sherry free. I think now they're charging like $2 or $3 for it. But it's still more or less free. And they can still, I mean, it's still people don't think about going there. Yeah. Donostia has a really nice sherry selection in East Village as well. And you're like, why aren't more people housing this? Like, you just, I buy sherry incessantly. This is like all I want to drink at home.
Yeah. It's one of the... I feel the same way. Like, before the break, we were talking about chartreuse and just, mm-hmm. like, hanging out with it and kind of, like, there's, like, this complete, they just like chilled out like vibe that I get from chartreuse. You just like sit there and sip it and just hang out and just, you know, really take a step back, you know. And I feel the same way about sherry.
Yeah. You know? Although the sherry hangover is far better.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but you're talking about 70 proof difference.
Pretty much. Oh, pretty significant there. Yeah. I think Toby Maloney was credited with calling the chartreuse hangover the charmousse, because it was like a moose was sitting on your head, crushing it. It was like, oh god, so much sugar. But you know, this is of course what happens when a couple bartenders go out and consume, say, a bottle of chartreuse between them or individually.
Chartreuse bottle service. Wow.
Not ideal. Yeah. It's like, sometimes questionable decisions get made after midnight, shockingly enough.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
I know. It's a weird thing. I figured I should probably bring that up for your audience. It's probably never been brought up on this show before.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's ever, that listens to my show, has ever stayed up past midnight.
No, definitely not. Not that they remembered.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of like Toby and you guys, Toby was actually, funnily enough, he was on the show like, I don't know, maybe a year ago, and it was a phone interview, and he happened to be like two blocks away.
Yeah, he lives in Williamsburg.
Yeah.
It's right around.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But speaking of the staff, you guys do something that's really cool. You guys actually rotate throughout the positions of the bar. So like one night you might host, one night you're a bartender, one night you're a server, right?
Yeah, I think what we've done is we've kept the front of the house positions fairly fluid. And that was part of the interview process. And that was a way to kind of like cull candidates as well. You know, if you tell someone who's coming to you saying like, I have a cocktail blog and I've created this many individual cocktails and they're wearing arm garters to the interview, you know, and you tell them like, yeah you're going to have to work the floor, and you watch them bristle.
Yeah.
When you say that, then you're like, yeah, I don't need this like wannabe startender as part of my staff. Yeah. Like, this is not an ego trip. This is about serving the guest. And if you have an issue with carrying a tray, if you think that makes you less than I don't need you to be part of the staff. And it was a good way to kind of cull a lot of that out of the staff. And so we were able to put together an extraordinarily strong team. In 18 months, we lost one guy very early on. But that was, I think, a mutually decided upon kind of like workplace culture, like mismatch. And he still continues to come in. He's still a friend. We love him. But we've lost two employees in 18 months.
That's amazing.
Which is a really good retention rate for this industry. And I think a lot of that has had to do with the fact that everyone gets treated equally. The staff, especially the first year, I think we took a much bigger role in kind of guiding the menu, and the drinks were largely, you know, those of the partners, and we were putting it, but that was because we had to establish a house style, you know, and I really wanted to figure out, what is a pouring ribbons drink? What does that mean? You know, and how does that translate? And how is that different from being a Death & Co. drink? How is that different from being something else? So it took a little while for us to kind of establish that house style. And then once we did, we really opened it up to the staff, because we had great staff members, some of whom who had worked in craft cocktail bars before, some of whom hadn't. We hired from all around the country, from Minneapolis, from Chicago, from Portland, from San Francisco. So we brought together a lot. I mean, from Queens. I mean, we weren't really far out. And so, you know, we brought together people from all over the place. And then now these last few menus, the staff has had a lot more contributions to go on these menus, where, like, I thankfully only had to put a few drinks on the current menu, which we launched on Monday. And it's like, oh, my God, thank God. I was only responsible for three or four of these. Like, score. Like,
yeah,
this
nice.
Is making my life so much easier. And it gives them ownership of the menu. So if someone says,
important.
Oh, are any of these drinks yours? They can proudly point to a couple of those.
Absolutely.
And say, oh, yeah, it's one of mine. And that's a huge thing. But it's also about, like, teaching someone how – when a drink is menu worthy, you know, like, does someone want five of these?
Yeah.
You know, is there something so compelling about this drink that maybe they won't drink five in a row, but they'll come back five straight Fridays to have one of these? They will compel their friends to come and do this. Like, and that's the whole thing. Like, is it a perfectly acceptable sour, or is this something that is memorable? And what the difference is between those, and when to use one versus the other.
Right.
So building the staff in terms of their ability to recognize when one thing has achieved that was big. But a lot of it was also like democratizing it. You know, I didn't want someone to go two pouring ribbons and say, oh, would you tell the mixologist that I like, you know, X, Y, and Z? And, you know, like, actually, this person who's, you know, carrying a tray and taking your order can answer every one of your questions just as intelligently as whoever's behind the bar, because if you come here tomorrow night, they'll be behind the bar, and the guy who you're calling this goofy title is going to be the one holding the tray, having this conversation with you, and you realize it's all meaningless.
Like,
they're staff, and, you know, everyone should be able to answer these questions, and everyone should be able to guide you to the right point, and that's where, you know, it really comes down to is cocktail bars make most of their money on the floor, and yet the bar gets fetishized.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, you've got to stop pretending that servers are second-class citizens, both as operators and as guests, because servers are the ones who are making the bulk of the sales, and they need to be just as trained up. All of, you know, our entire staff sits in and weighs in on cocktail trainings. And when I'm coming up with recipes, the first thing I do is do two or three versions, blind taste the staff on them. I don't tell them what's different about it. And I just wanted honest opinions. Which do you like? Why? Yeah. And we go from there. Half the time, it's not the one that I would have liked. You know, but if the entire staff seems to like this version more, I'm like, ah, my palate's a little weird. Okay, that's cool. Yeah. You know, and they're like, I think if as long as they're objectively
maybe
balanced.
Maybe I had too much ham and sherry last night.
Yeah, possibly, you know. But, you know, I think if you're creating drinks that are objectively balanced, and from there, it's all preference. And some of it is, I think I could sell more of this. Then sometimes you have to think, well, I think this weirder version is cooler. Maybe that's not the one you want on your menu. Maybe that's the one that you kind of keep in your back pocket for when your bartender friends show up and they want that thing that's weird. And you make that substitution on the fly. But for the most part, you would try to pick the one that has a consensus most appeal. But the way we've laid out the menu on that graph between spiritus to refreshing and comforting to adventurous gives us a lot of flexibility with that. And that whole graph layout was basically born out of the questions that you would ever talk to a guest about anyway. Like, you want something boozy or do you want something citrusy?
Yeah.
You know?
Start shaking.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly a conversation we've had a million times. We just basically had it laid out in a graph. So, if someone doesn't know what a Genepi is or a Gentian or whatever, like, they're not supposed to. They just want to get drunk. they don't need to know about obscure French things. Like, that's cool. That's our job. Here, look. It's all on a graph. Point.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Man. It's worked out.
I think it's really cool that you've, like, going back to the whole thing about, like, you know, like, kind of, like, de-romanticizing the role of the goofy nickname, the mixologist, you know, like, and putting it into terms where it's like, all right, guys, everyone in this room is here for a reason, and everyone that works here knows this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, ask the host about, you know, the history of chartreuse, about the Carthusian monastery, you know, just like
they sit in on the trainings. Everyone does, you know, and that's the whole point. And, you know, that's actually been one of the great things that I've seen, especially in the last couple of years. I know Jim Meehan has done this for a few years. Naren Young has done this quite a bit. Where they're inviting staffs from other bars to sit in on their staff trainings
and kind of
brand things. And so we've started to do that as well, where it's a great thing. You know, like, some things are, you know, you don't have to invite four other bar staff to your menu tasting, but it's cool when you can get someone who's going to talk about cool cognacs or mezcals or rum agricole or whatever it is, and you can open that up to 30 or 40 people instead of 12. So I think that kind of shared learning experience is something that you're seeing as there's an increasing saturation in the kind of craft cocktail movement. You're seeing it spread out between more casual outlets to more kind of craft cocktail bars to restaurants to everything else. We're all each other's waiting rooms. And so kind of that notion of a rising tide lifts all ships, we're, you know, everyone's less proprietary about seven. It's like, hey, you guys should come. You know, I've got these great people coming to talk to my staff. Would any of your staff like to come? I could probably take five people from your staff. And, you know, how do you do that? And so we're seeing that more and more and more. And I love that. I love the fact that just let's get this information out there. Like,
absolutely,
if someone has a great experience because they went to Saxon and Parole or Empeyon or PDT, and they come back and they talk to them, we're like, oh yeah, we were at that tasting. We did, you know, we know those ingredients too, and we offer them as well, or we can talk about them. Or if you like that, then we have something similar and it's this, then that's just better for everyone, you know? And it's like, we're all neighbors. We're not competitors.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that, because that's one of the things I think about so much. And especially with, the part of town where your bar is and the bars that you worked at before, it's like, it's just such a community driven, amazing experience to work in and go to and visit these great cocktail bars. And I always say cocktail bar. A cocktail bar is kind of like a restaurant, a food restaurant. It's like just kind of redundant, but it's great bars and with great people and great, atmosphere and that energy of, I really like that idea. I think I'm doing a menu change soon, so I'm probably I would love for you to come by and taste some stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
True. Hey, I mean, I'm in the hood.
Yeah, exactly.
I live very close by.
I think it's also a testament to the boomerang. You know, it's like you're talking about the other people, like that neighborhood. That
was
your bar is
hysterical
in.
When that got published in the Times.
That's so good.
Unattributed. Because no one wanted a cop to it. That was great. I mean, but again, that. Something like the boomerang serves a variety of functions. One, you're obviously sending it to the staff of another bar to take a cheeky shot, mm-hmm. you know, and it not come out of their own bar's pour costs and therefore not incurring the wrath of whoever the manager on duty is. but a lot of it is also about marking the guest who brings it, you know, and especially when you're looking at 40, 50 seat cocktail bars, if someone is showing up with a shot, you know, with a inflated rubber glove with something welcomingly profane scrawled on it, then they know, like, okay, you know, this staff,
like,
who we trust
basically
sent this person with this, and maybe I should prioritize them, and maybe they should be able to get in a little sooner, maybe we should, you know, pay attention because maybe they're industry from out of town, maybe they're just great bar guests, you know, maybe they really took care of the staff there, like, for whatever reason. And that's a great way to kind of mark and flag guests as well. And so we use that not only just to kind of say hi to our friends, but also to flag certain guests to our friends, you know, especially when they're just people who would otherwise be unknown there. And this it allows them to kind of pay a little bit more attention to them and hopefully continue to make their experience in yet another New York bar all the more special. And that's a beautiful thing about traveling, is when you go somewhere and you come away with a great story. And, you know, it's a cool thing to go back to Copenhagen and say, yeah, I ferried this, you know, shot glass with a with a glove coming out of it with a message scrawled on it, you know, from one bar to another. I took it to the Dead Rabbit, or I took it to Death & Co, or I took it to EO or whatever. Yeah. It was like, I don't know why, but it got me in. And, you know, like, that's a good story, you know. So you can tell that one for a while, and it's fun. And, you know, then you probably got to take part in that shot, too. And life was good.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And life is good, man. And I'm so glad that you... you got your spot rocking and rolling, man. And I'd love going there, and I can't wait to come back again. I was going to pop in a couple weeks ago with Tiki Adam on his orgeat delivery, but we had just been upstate. So I was like, I'm just going to stay in the car. Shannon was working, so I probably should have come in and said hi.
Yeah. But, she's pretty exceptional. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, come on by. We just put out a new menu on Monday. All 15 house drinks are new. We updated or changed out all 15 of the classics. So it's the biggest menu change we've done so far, is everything got either changed or updated. So a lot of new stuff to drink your way through.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Can't wait to. Joaquin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Always
man.
Such a pleasure.
And come back, you know, anytime you feel like.
I'd be happy to.
All right, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. All right, cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.